Jones, we have top men working on it right now.
It was a most ripping victory.
No! Get to the chopper!
Welcome to the Parkway Theater Podcast. If you don't recognize that beat, you will be shocked at what we're discussing today. I'm one of your hosts, Matt, from the Fun V Podcast.
And I'm Byron, also from the Fun V Podcast.
And I am Ward from the Parkway Theater.
This is 1982's classic, and I mean, oh, so sweet classic, The Thing, John Carpenter. My God, I cannot wait to jump into this with you guys, but let's first talk about what we're drinking. What are you drinking? And I think Byron pointed out in the pre-production meeting, Byron pointed out that this is a test. Tell us what you're drinking, and if it's not right, we may have to flamethrower you. Byron, you go first.
I'm drinking.
Wait, Byron, you first. I'm.
This is the ultimate test. I am drinking the flamethrower chai from the Parkway Theater when they did this film. It has a Red Hots candy infused whiskey. It has chai and also has some cinnamon bitters in it.
Excellent. You pass. Why don't you come over here?
I'm pretty sure.
Clearly.
Why don't you come over here and man the flamethrower?
Nope.
Man the flamethrower with me while we pointed at Ward. Ward, you tell us what you're drinking over there.
I'm drinking Jim Beam on Ice, so I think that Byron clearly is the thing.
Jim Beam on Ice. Now, that is a question I have. I don't really understand what J and B is, but I think that's a different thing than Jim Beam, right?
Oh, really? Did I get it wrong?
I think it's
J. You got it wrong.
And B.
Jeez! I'm an alien.
That's exactly what we were waiting to uncover. So, Byron.
I tried to sound human. I tried so hard to sound
Byron,
human.
Byron, you better flame his ass. This is over. It's a two-man show now.
I thought that's what humans do. They drink Jim Beam.
Not in Antarctica. That's not what the stash is. Yeah, so... So this is that movie. It's fantastic, and like I said, I can't wait to get in. Let's just jump right into the numbers. I have a feeling we're gonna go talk about this movie for quite a while. The cast of this movie. This is, of course, and now this is 1982 is the thing. If anybody wants to make jokes, we can wait till a little bit later. This is the one that stars Kurt Russell, okay, as MacReady. It's got the Oats Man, the Oats Man himself. Wilford Brimley. Everybody knows him, of course.
Does it, though?
Well,
does it?
I don't know.
Because if Wilford Brimley doesn't have a mustache, I don't know that he's actually Wilford
Brimley.
Well,
I mean, they clearly didn't completely imitate his mustache. That was a failure in his ability to the alien's ability. It's got T.K. Carter. I could name every single... I think I might do that. I usually don't name everyone, but in this movie, I'm going to name everyone. T.K. Carter as Knowles, David Clennon as Palmer, Keith David, holy cow, 80s, 90s, superstar sci-fi actor, Keith David as Childs, Richard Dysart as Cooper, Charles Hallahan, he was everywhere, also in the 80s, Vance Norris, Peter Maloney as Bennings, Richard Masseur, he was everywhere as Clark, Donald Moffat, everywhere as Gary, he's the guy from Babe, if I'm not mistaken, right? He's Babe, the farmer or whatever. Joel Polis as Fuchs.
Not Hume Cronin.
Now you're right. They look the same. You're right. No, it's not because the age difference does not line up.
They do. It's James Cromwell was Babe. Cromwell.
So Moffat looks like him. Thomas Waits as Windows. Man, I like that guy a lot. Norbert Weiser as the Norwegian. And Larry Franco as the Norwegian passenger with the rifle who's shooting at the dog. Nate Irwin as the helicopter pilot. This movie, directed by John Carpenter, written by the screenplay. Okay, I want to talk to Byron about this, I think. That the screenplay is by Bill Lancaster, based on the 1938 novella by John Campbell Jr., which was called Who Goes There? And, you know, I don't usually do this, but because I think I'm going to start doing this, because this movie and future movies we do, if they're super good, spoiler alert, I like this movie, I'm going to also go into more details about who made this movie. So two more things beyond director and writer. Cinematography on this movie, Dean Cundey. You guys, can you name anything Dean Cundey has done? Just give me one. Anybody?
I believe he did It's a Wonderful Life, didn't he?
You notice I didn't say his name during that podcast, so I don't know, but I'm going to say no.
He did. I've already looked it up, so I'm cheating.
Okay. Well,
The Human Tornado, that's what he did.
Yeah, so I didn't have to. Well, I mean, I had to look it up to get the details, but I didn't have to look it up to know his name. I mean, this guy is just superstar DP and cinematographer. He did Halloween 1 and 2 and 3, Escape from New York, Back to the Future 1 and 2 and 3, mm-hmm. Jurassic Park, Apollo 13. So we're talking, dinosaurs, outer space, futuristic vehicle travel, post-apocalyptic stuff, slasher films. The guy does everything. And then the last thing. Yeah, go ahead.
I think you're missing one of his most best contributions.
Which
to
is?
The cinema universe.
Which is?
1997, director Les Mayfield of Flubber.
Oh, did he do Flubber? For. He did Flubber. I guess I did miss that one. I do like me some Flubber.
Cinematography in that movie was awesome.
I do like me some Flubber, so I guess that counts. And then
it's like the Revenant of 80s cinematography, 90s.
Yeah. That's definitely Eddie Murphy's Revenant role right there, where he's attacked by a giant fat professor who eats him, basically.
No, that's the Nutty Professor.
No, Flubber is the Nutty Professor, right? That's just.
Oh, is it? I thought Flubber was Robin Williams.
Maybe Byron.
Yeah, Flubber is Robin Williams.
Oh, okay. Yes, sorry. That's exactly, yep, okay. Wow, I am going to hang up my hat and let someone else. I am clearly not human. That's what it is. I'm not human. The creature effects on this movie, I did not know this name, but we can get into it later. This the effects here were done by a guy named Rob Botten, which, like I said, we'll cover that a little bit more later. Budget $15 million. This poor movie, gentlemen, only made $20 million in its initial box office opening. $20 million. It didn't cover its... it covered its production budget, but didn't cover its marketing. So it was kind of a flop at the time. I am shocked. I was shocked to learn that. Currently, it has an 85% rotten tomato meter rating for critics and 92 audience ratings. So this is not a flop. It just was a flop at the time. So the last thing we say here on the numbers is IMDb plot summary: a research team in Antarctica is hunted by a shape-shifting alien that assumes the appearance of its victims. Ugh, this movie is fantastic. That's how I'm going to start this review, or this discussion, or whatever we call these things. What is, Byron, your impression? We always have to ask you, had you seen this movie, and what was your impression of it, your first impression?
I can admit that I had not seen this movie, but I know I had seen a lot of clips to this movie. It was nice before reviewing this film. It was actually nice to put them all together. It certainly made it that much more enjoyable. I want to take a quick second. I know you had talked about some of the other production people. I want to say I love this film. I'm so glad you guys asked me to watch this and review this because of how much I loved it. I want to take a second. There's another person... very famous person that's on this production crew, who
I know where you're going with this one.
Huh?
He says he knows where you're going.
I know where you're going.
Let's let Ward get a lot of credit.
Something that's not really thought about. It was even in the intro. You could even hear it. The music in this film.
Okay.
Done.
Ennio Morricone, my favorite of all time.
Yes, exactly. One of my favorite composers or people who do music in films. And he certainly sets the entire tone of this film.
Let's say the name again because you talked over each other. Well, who is it?
Ennio Morricone, I believe is how you pronounce it.
Yeah, that's how I was going to say it. I was going to let you say it, Ward, because I'm not sure how to say it. But I believe it's Ennio Morricone.
Yeah.
And he's done some of my favorite soundtracks of all time. And, I always assumed that John Carpenter did his own music on all of his movies. So I was kind of, I didn't remember that it was Morricone when the movie started. And, it's so cool.
Apparently on this one, Carpenter didn't have time to do the soundtrack. So he said, hey, you do this, buddy. And it worked great.
Well, yeah, that's a little shocking to think of, but I was blown away by just the sound of this whole film. It was really just listening to it. If you ever get a chance, one thing I did just to mess with it, I actually listened to it on mute for a little while. Totally is not scary at all. It's almost laughable. It's almost like a comedy.
Well, so that's the thing is Carpenter was afraid that the audiences would laugh when they did the initial screenings, because he didn't know how any of this would be perceived. I mean, you can imagine without some of the sound and some of the special effects, it would be pretty laughable, like you said. So he quickly was his concerns were alleviated after he saw the screenings. So that's another part of the lore of this movie.
Oh yeah.
If you guys would like a treat, go on YouTube and watch a supercut of John Carpenter and Kurt Russell, their Blu-ray commentary of this movie. It's basically just 5 minutes of Kurt Russell laughing hysterically, and it will brighten your day. I'm telling you, it's so funny.
Well, let's talk about Kurt Russell, because I have to say, without Kurt Russell, this movie doesn't work. I mean, so here's what I did. I watched this movie, tell you how I experienced it. I watched the 2011 movie, and then I watched it run right into back-to-back viewings, the 1982 movie, and then this morning I read the novella to get the background, whatever story from whatever the 1938 book that it was written on, based on. And as I was reading that novella, it's 40 pages long. The voice in my head was Kurt Russell. Every time it was MacReady. I think this guy is just meant to play this type of character. And I could say the same for Big Trouble in Little China. I could say the same for Stargate, the Stargate movie that came out where he was the colonel or captain or whatever. Almost anything for Escape from New York. I mean, this does not work without Kurt Russell. And I might say the same for Keith David, too, because Keith David is phenomenal as the counterpart to this rough, gruff, whatever, American guy. So, I don't want to listen to the audio commentary by Kurt Russell, because I only see Kurt Russell as MacReady.
Well, spoiler alert, Kurt Russell thinks this movie is really funny. So he probably fulfilled all of John Carpenter's fears going into it. One thing, so first of all, I love this movie as well. I'm a huge fan. I've seen this movie probably 30 times. And I actually, we'll get into this later, but I saw things came up for me watching it this time that I hadn't thought of before. But one of the things I want to just bring up quick, because you mentioned the prequel from 2011, which I hate. I hate that movie because of how, the CGI replaces all the awesome practical effects from this movie. But also, it kind of reminds me of Alien. Like, I like the prequel to Alien, but I didn't need it. And it's the same thing with this. It's like, I kind of like this movie where the Norwegian camp is just this mysterious, you don't really know what the hell happened. And I didn't really need to know you know, that Joel Edgerton was there and that everybody spoke English and that there was a bunch of CGI
disagree.
Going on. I just like this movie
disagree
on its own.
Entirely.
Agreed.
100% disagree. I mean, I could not disagree more. Byron, so are you Byron, have you seen the, so you've seen the 2011, is what you're saying?
I have seen parts of the 2011, and really, for me personally, I don't think it needed to be shown either. This film, the 1982 film, does a very good job of show, don't tell, and one thing John Carpenter is good at is leaving things up to the imagination, which I'm fine with leaving things up to the imagination about how they discovered the alien craft and did all this stuff. I mean, we got everything we needed to know from the 1982 film.
Yeah, so the 2011, so first of all, it's not a remake and it's not a reboot. The 2011 movie actually, in most points, sticks. And so it sticks closer to the novella. Byron, did you read the novella? I count on you to do the reading.
I did read the novella. Okay. I thought it was pretty good.
I thought you might. So I know you're our reader in this group. But so you may agree with me then. So in that 1938 story, it's all about them discovering the thing, and none of that happens in the 1982 movie. So I'm curious why Carpenter made the decision to tell the story of the dog coming to the American camp. I have to believe that 1982, the reason was because they said, no one's going to listen to Norwegian accents or Norwegian language and, you know, or subtitles. And so we need to make it like translated to America, yada, yada, yada. I don't know why he did the things he did, but when they made that 2011 movie, the prequel, it told the story kind of like, very much like the novella and how they discovered it and they pulled it out and all these things. And I think that there has never been a greater prequel movie made. I watched it, I mean, it explains, it doesn't explain, here's the thing, it doesn't explain anything about, I mean, it really doesn't, it doesn't explain things that you didn't, it doesn't talk about midichlorians, right? So everybody hates midichlorians.
Yeah, that's what
Star
we're going
Wars,
for.
Right?
That's what we're trying to avoid is the midichlorians.
But what you have, what you have in 2011, you have this Norwegian camp. The only problem they have with that movie, I think, is that they had to bring in the female American biologist or whatever her actual degree or whatever is in, and then they have Joel Edgerton, who plays too much of a Kurt Russell character. If they didn't have those people, and it was just a Norwegian camp in Antarctica, I think that would be just absolutely perfect, because if you have an alien thing that they find and you're isolated in Antarctica, then you're going to behave a certain way because you have a limited amount of supplies, a limited amount of weapons, a limited amount of, you know, travel and technology. So you're going to have a very similar response to this threat that you'd have over at the American Antarctic camp. And so they tell the story of how the Norwegians responded to it. And none of it is like, here's the backstory of MacReady. Like most Hollywood prequels go like, oh, here's MacReady as a child and he started at the Norwegian camp and then he had to move, you know, like there's a backstory. None of this is a backstory. It's just the alien invasion of one camp, and then the connecting thread is the dog running and the helicopter chasing it to the other camp. And there is no confounding, annoying, like explaining why this or why that or why the alien. It didn't give us alien motivations. It just said, "Oh, the alien attacked this camp, and then it attacked that camp." And like, I was like, "Oh my god, it's
amazing!"
But
they never do. It doesn't explain why the Norwegians are just so incredibly incompetent, terrible shots, and don't know how to handle a grenade.
It doesn't have to though. I mean, that's a joke, of course, haha. But the thing is, you have one of my favorite actors from the era of Game of Thrones, right? The red-headed, bearded guy who plays, well, I don't know what his name is in Game of Thrones, but he's so...
Tormund.
Yeah, he's so funny. He's so funny, and he's in this movie. And I actually really appreciate the 2011 prequel where they where, you know, there's so much. I mean, you said everyone speaks English, but there's actually a fair amount of subtitles in Norwegian that they're speaking. And I just think that it is shockingly
good. Hold on,
good
now. Which movie are we reviewing here?
You know, we talk. Are we still there? Everybody still there?
Yep.
Oh, I got it. Ward,
I'm here.
Okay, Ward, you there? We lost Ward. We lost Ward. He'll call back. But Byron, you've seen bits and pieces of it. We'll give Ward a call here, see what happens. And I mean, I want to keep making my case Now we've got Ward back.
You know, I think I had a point I think I wanted to bring up about this. You talked about how John Carpenter decided to kind of create his own screenplay off of this, almost like he's almost writing a sequel in a way with this.
Mm-hmm.
And using the novella and using that. There was a film in 1951 that was also based on it. It was called The Thing from Another World,
yeah,
which does follow the novella a little bit closer. I wonder if he was trying to not just do a remake of that film.
So that film, Byron, which I did not watch, the monster doesn't even imitate the people on the camp. So it is.
Oh, all right.
Is that the film that they show on the TV in Halloween?
Yes, it is. That's exactly what it is. Okay. But because that monster in that film doesn't imitate the humans, I do not believe it's a remake for that single reason.
I guess I'm not saying that it's a remake. I'm saying that's probably the motivation behind why John Carpenter didn't want to make another film of that. You know, didn't want to do the Norwegian camp.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean,
that's my only argument, I guess, is it, and I'm just mind reading at this point. I don't know for sure.
Well, it's funny you said mind reading, because that is one of the skills, of course.
That was in the novella. Yeah,
of the monster in the novella.
Also, do was mind read.
Right, it's a mind reader in the novel novella. And
one thing that was also different from the novella that I kind of liked and would have been more fascinated, I think, to see this, was that it was actually set back in the 1930s rather than, say, the 1980s.
Well, because, you know, I mean, it was written in the 30s.
It's a small thing, but, I mean, what I thought was more interesting then was them trying to use science against it.
Oh, they did,
because,
yeah.
You know what? Because what they had to do, they couldn't just take a vial of blood and try to compare it. You know, they couldn't see if there was in the same way, like, a germ was taking over the body. They had to, like, create a culture out of a dog. Like,
yeah,
by like slowly inoculating it with human blood.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, in the novella, MacReady was a meteorologist who had gone through medical school, but in here he's a pilot, which we've buried the lead. I have to say, we buried the lead. Does anybody else here desperately want to order on the internet MacReady's hat?
Yes,
that hat.
I want that GD hat.
Yes, I do.
Yeah. That is the best. I mean, the fact that he unironically wears around the most giant, I don't know what you'd even call that, sombrero with the folded brim, you know?
It's like amazing. It's like he lost a bet and had to wear that.
Yeah.
And then, like on set, and like, mm-hmm. like, hey, Anino, you got something from your Western get-up? Wear that.
Yeah, right. But not even totally Western. It's more, I mean, it's just so hilariously tall and wide and bent in odd angles. I just love it. It's, I mean, I might have to order one right now. Let's see. But speaking of that, we can talk about not the costume, but the special effects. I mentioned this guy, Rob Bottin. So he had previously done Total Recall and RoboCop. So you can think of when Schwarzenegger's, his face opens up when he's busted as an old fat lady in the Mars transportation station. His face comes apart in these six or eight segments. That was Rob Bottin. Apparently the guy was pretty stressed about this movie. He had to be hospitalized. Did you guys read any of this trivia?
I did not. But I will say that I feel like that is this guy who... it's a shame that he didn't get more credit. Like, he's not on the same, known on the same level as Stan Winston. But I don't think a movie like this could exist now, because I don't think I think it's that's a lost art. I don't know that there are people that do practical effects to that. They're just not affordable, and it's all CGI now.
Well, there are people who do that. In fact, they go to the Stan Winston School of Special Effects, and you should follow them on Twitter, or not on Twitter, on Instagram. I follow them on Instagram. It's crazy. They have all kinds of contests about, like, they have listeners or subscribers or whatever, or students, former students. They have contests about submitting various things that are practical special effects.
Do you see these kind of practical effects in movies anymore?
I don't think you do, because what they do now is they mix them with CGI, so that anything that is, you know, cheaper to do CGI, they just do it that way. Even if it's like a mask, right, a latex mask, they blend the edges with CGI, so it's not the same. But I am watching this movie, and I'm thinking, I was watching this, I'm thinking, I love this. I don't care that it doesn't seem totally 100% real, 100%, you know. I mean, there's obviously, like, when the spider legs come out and there's all this stuff, I'm thinking, it's not just nostalgia for me. I'm thinking, this is like, I mean, I'm watching a movie, so I don't expect it to be real, but it looks so good that I love it. And this guy, when he did this stuff,
yeah,
21 years old. That's it, 21. Unbelievable.
Wow.
And it's funny that you mentioned Stan Winston, because actually this guy stressed himself out, got hospitalized with double pneumonia and a bleeding ulcer, which is all just various stress symptoms. And so he couldn't finish the special effects on this movie. And you know who did? Stan Winston actually did. So he didn't take credit. He's an industry legend, and he said, okay, I'll help you out. And he helped him out, and they thanked him in the end credits, somewhere buried amongst all the text at the end. But he wouldn't take a screen credit for doing a special effect. So pretty, I mean, he's a great guy. I think everyone who's commented on it I've ever seen thinks he's a great guy. But it's awesome that you know, this Rob Bottin guy did all this stuff with a little bit of help from Stan, and it looks so good. It looks like Alien. It looks like Terminator.
Yeah.
It's amazing. He's 21 years old. I don't know how to do that.
Yeah, it's certainly the one thing that I was noting out of this. It's simultaneously surreal, and it seems very much organic. That's what I'm looking at. It actually looks like an organism. It's not a CGI'd perfect creation.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
The other thing about this movie, like, it's the makeup is awesome. Like, the special effects are so good. But the other thing that I think is equally amazing is that this movie, for me, I feel like each character has, like, this rich, I'm not going to say backstory, but I feel like each character is really distinct, and you kind of align with certain characters and you love certain characters, but there's literally no backstory. Yep. Like, not one
Agreed.
Of them
Agreed.
Did they
there's
tell you where they
little,
came from, how they
get,
got up there.
You get just a little bit, and it's just enough to give them a little bit of depth, and then you're able to distinguish them.
Yeah. Right.
Totally.
And I think some of that has to do with the fact that these are men on a research expedition in the Antarctic, and there can be no overlap. You know, it's like, that guy's the dog guy, okay? Carl, he takes care of the dogs, right? And then Norris, he's the meteorologist, okay? That guy over there, that's the biologist. Blair, you know, he's the one. And so it's almost like a built-in delineation between archetypes that exists in the real world, because when they, you know, when the U.S. government or whoever pays to send people all the way to Antarctica or whatever, they don't have, like, oh, well, there's 10 secretaries and 42 VPs and, you know, like, all these, like, overlapping characters. It's just like, these are the people. They have to be distinct. And it works.
And it's so efficient.
Right, it's efficient.
I mean, you know all of that without them really telling us
right.
anything.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. And I think it has to do with the setting that they're in. The efficiency is required because they're in the Antarctic. Let's talk about the setting. The setting is The reason we're discussing this movie now is because it's cold and icy and dark in Minnesota, and where we're podcasting from. And it's like the, I don't know, the 10th or 12th or whatever character in the movie is the setting of the frozen tundra-ness and the dark that they, you know, I mean, they really sell it because everything counts on them having supplies. Everything counts on them having electricity. And when it goes out, or the generator goes out, or the radio goes out, it just adds to the suspense. And I just love it. I mean, it's amazing. Better than anything, I don't know, maybe anything I've ever seen. I don't know. I just love it so much. Do you guys think the setting is a major character here?
The camp. The camp is very cool. Without understanding, I still don't really understand the layout of the camp as many times I've watched this movie. But yeah, absolutely. It's so, like, the idea of how cold it is out there, and how, you know, the end of the movie where you just, I don't want to get to the end of the movie yet. But yeah, I agree.
Yeah, just that overwhelming sense of isolation and just the unknown. As you go to the edge of the camp, you just don't see anything. Just kind of, it narrows the whole world down to just these couple little buildings and everything. And it really just adds to that whole tension anymore as well.
Yeah, and apparently the way, you know, because we previously on this podcast talked about Carpenter's production of Halloween, and how it was, I believe, $300,000 production budget, and it made, you know, millions and gajillions. But because he comes from that school of low budget filmmaking, apparently what they did to film the start of the movie, the Norwegian camp, they filmed that as the very last thing, because they just filmed the American camp but blown up after, at the very end of the movie. You know, in the chronological sequence of the movie, everything gets blown up and set on fire. And so they do that to the set that they built for the American camp, and then that becomes the opening of the movie for the Norwegian camp that underwent the alien attack. So as I was watching, I thought, that's weird that they have, like, that radio tower dome-looking thing, like, right at the same place as the American camp. I wonder if that's like a I wonder if that's like a standard Antarctic expedition design or something. But nope, it's the same set. So yeah, it's incredible.
So can we get into some, there's the one big obvious question. But the other question I have for you guys is, at what point during this movie did Blair become the thing? Was it before he destroyed the helicopter and all that stuff, or was it sometime after?
For my own personal theory, I think it was after. In order for, I guess, my own made-up timeline to work. I think he was attacked because he was isolated enough that he was able to be attacked while he was isolated and secured.
Yeah, I also agree with that. I know, actually, before we started podcasting, I watched a 12-minute YouTube video about when exactly everyone, in theory, was imitated or assimilated. And I still couldn't tell you. I mean, I don't even remember what they said about Blair. But I think that they all had a good intention of destroying this thing's ability to escape, and that's why Blair, you know, disabled the helicopters and stuff. I think, because in the movie they left him out there for 2 days. He's in that other house for 2 days. In the novella they left him out there for a week. So I think it was actually in those 2 days that somehow the thing got to him. That's my guess. What do you think?
I guess I thought yesterday when I watched it, it was the first time I thought, oh, I wonder if he destroyed the, if he wasn't really destroying the helicopter, if he was just getting parts to build the other little flying saucer. I don't know. But I don't know. One of the things I do love about that, though, with Blair in isolation, is how MacReady goes out to check on him, and he's got a noose hanging there. Like, he's obviously going to kill himself, and MacReady just doesn't even give a shit. He doesn't even He doesn't even make a comment about it. He's just like, you doing okay in there? All right, bye.
Like I said, I just love Kurt Russell in this movie. I mean, I love him in Big Trouble in Little China. Very similar. This is just phenomenal. but I think that's a good point, maybe, because at the end of this movie, Blair is trying to make a spaceship. They go down into a tunnel under the ice, and they see he's making a spaceship. In the end of the novella, Byron, do you want to give us the details on what they're doing there?
Like you had said, they left Blair there for a week, and it turned out that among many of his little creations that he was making, it was some sort of, I'm blanking on that, it was like some sort of anti-gravity type device that he was going to do. And I remember specifically, I wrote this down in my notes, they had the quote in the book, some sort of cold fusion.
Yeah, it was atomic energy because...
that's what it was.
In 1938, they didn't, you know, obviously they no one knew that we had cracked the atomic bomb code yet. And so in 1938, they said, well, this alien has made atomic energy, and he's going to use it to power this anti-gravity device. And that's how he's going to get to America or whatever.
Split the atom and created fusion.
Or off-world.
Or something.
Right. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know when we could ask that question about any of the other people too. Like, and I guess, you know, we're going to get to the very end of this movie, but as far as like the other people who we don't see get attacked,
I had something for that.
Go ahead.
Kind of something similar to that. Do you guys remember there's right after, I think we, it's right after the first attack, we end up seeing the silhouette in the hallway of the dog as it's going towards a room.
Yep.
Did you guys ever come up with your own theory of who that was?
I saw a theory online about that, but.
Yeah, I mean, I saw somebody who broke down, like, you know, which actors were on set and the collar is up, and I always assumed it was the dog guy, but obviously not, because he doesn't turn out to be the thing. I don't know. Matt, what's your theory there?
Oh, yeah, I guess the only thing that I had was I thought it was going to be Palmer, because that would have made sense that he just had been there, or that it would have just been Palmer, and then that he had the most access to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the thing other people say is Norris was possibly.
That's a good one, too.
Yeah. Based on like the collar and the whatever, the clothing and the hair. But I mean, I have to say,
I think it's a bummer, by the way, that Palmer is the thing when he utters the best line in the entire movie.
Are you fucking kidding me? That one?
You gotta be fucking kidding me.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's true.
I think in the novella, they make more of a point to say because it's a mind reader and because it can like tap into your entire essence, that the thing can actually pretty convincingly emulate you and say things that you would say. So that's more scary than even in the movie has. The 2011 one, this is a spoiler for people who haven't seen that, but the 2011 one,
spoiler alert.
The 2011, I think they actually do a pretty good job where they say, oh, this thing can't emulate non-organic or inorganic materials. So she goes around checking everyone's fillings. And some people say, oh, they're porcelain, so you can't see the silver metallic color in my mouth. But in this one, they don't have any of that. They go straight to the blood test, which is also in the book. And there's also sabotage in the book and the movie, or sorry, the book, this movie, and the 2011 movie. There's also, oh my God, someone sabotaged the test that we were going to do. It's very convenient in all three.
Yeah, it was a pretty good little reveal in the novella. I certainly enjoyed that. Do you guys really have you thought or your own personal timeline of who you think got infected when?
Well, that was the YouTube video I watched, and it didn't really contribute to my understanding, because I thought that it's like it kind of looked into it too deep, you know, who was first and who was second, and I don't think the movie needs that. basically. I mean, if you have yours, I'm definitely here to listen. But I just thought, well, I don't need that. So
I guess that was the point I was going to make. It was going to be kind of a trick question because I think John Carpenter was interviewed and he actually said there was no official canonized version. He left it up he intentionally left it unsolvable.
Yeah.
For that specific reason.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. I think that makes sense. Which leads us, I guess, right into the finale, the final scene, which is also unsolvable. Do we...
I disagree.
Okay, well, we're going to go there. So then, Ward, set us up with the final scene. What do we know? What don't we know?
Yeah, so I've seen this movie, you know, probably 20 times. This is the first time I've ever watched this movie, and I decided definitively who is the thing at the end. You know, you've got MacReady and Childs out in the cold, and they meet up, and they decide they're just going to sit and wait it out. So early in the movie, so here's my evidence, and I've never picked up on this before. Early in the movie, when they realize how easily it can be transmitted, they decide that they're not going to share
food
anything anymore, food-wise. Yeah, oh, we're going to start eating out of cans and whatever.
I see where you're going with this.
So MacReady, so if you watch the scene again, MacReady takes his bottle. He's about to take a drink out of it, and then Childs shows up. And they kind of go back and forth a little bit. And then MacReady kind of gives this look, and he hands the bottle to Childs, and Childs just immediately takes a swig of it. And then MacReady just kind of gives this little half smile.
And he
almost
laughs.
Like,
he laughs.
I knew it. Like,
yeah,
I knew
he
it.
He full laughs. Yeah.
And, yeah. So I feel like in that moment, MacReady knows that Childs is the thing because he took a drink out of it because why not? He's already the thing.
Byron, what do you
think? I like this. This is the first time hearing it. But yeah, I really like that idea. I was going to just be controversial and say it was MacReady the entire time. But no, I like this idea better.
Yeah. So the other thing that I've heard multiple other things related to that last scene. And one of them is that bottle that MacReady passed over was actually a Molotov cocktail full of gasoline. And so Keith David Childs drinks gasoline, doesn't even flinch. And that's an...
The problem with that is that MacReady was about to take a swig from it before Childs showed up.
Yeah, I don't think... I don't know if that's true. I mean, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I don't know.
The other thing I saw was that there was one of the production guys that he supposedly telegraphed who's the thing and who's not based on whether or not there was a tiny little reflection in their eyes. Did you hear that theory?
That was my man, Dean Cundey. Dean Cundey said that, so it's got to be true.
Yeah, and so supposedly, and if you watch that last scene, MacReady has a little reflection in his eyes, but Childs doesn't.
Yeah, well, I think the most definitive answer to this is that they actually filmed an alternate ending where MacReady is flown home, goes to a conference room in some actual, you know, science, whatever, a building, a civilization, and gets tested, and they show that he was negative for it. So there's a definitive ending from John Carpenter that was filmed but never really advertised or obviously wasn't included in the movie. So I mean, definitely MacReady was not infected or assimilated. I don't know what happens to Keith David in that alternate ending. The thing that was kind of, I don't know.
I think he goes on to team up with Rowdy Roddy Piper after
God dang
the
it.
Infection
now you're talking,
has
now
spread.
You're talking my movie right there. They Live. They Live is one of the best movies. I still wear my sunglasses that I got free from the Parkway Theater at the screening of They Live last year. That's my only sunglasses that I ever wear. And I see aliens all the time in my sunglasses from the Parkway. But no, so the thing that I don't like about the 2011 remake, the main thing that's they kind of capitulated to the audience at the end, is Joel Edgerton's character gets found out by Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character because he doesn't have his earring replicated in him when he's an alien. And And so she blasts him in the snow cat with the fire, whatever it's called, a thing. And so then, in that movie, it actually is just one person that we believe, I think we're pretty sure, is not an alien. She gets in a snow cat and she gets to go home. Whereas in this movie, I like it better because it's just, you know, it's two people and they just say, yeah, let's just sit here and find out a while. And we believe, I think, that none of them gets to go home until the alien dies. And that's better. It's a more cinematic, more poetic ending than that other one. But the beauty of the other one...
Or freezes,
yeah.
And until somebody else finds
it. That is true. Mm-hmm. I mean, it probably won't die because, you know, it's going to freeze. And poor Kurt Russell is just going to die. But the beauty is that in the other one, they show how Joel Edgerton's character is so convincing about, let's do this and let's do that and we'll make sure everything's safe and let's get home. And, you know, and he's just, I mean, the alien playing MacReady in that one is very convincing about that. It's not maniacal or murderous. It's just like, I'm making a lot of sense. We should go home. We should do this and that. And so I think that really bleeds into this movie, where you don't know the people who are the alien could be making a lot of sense and could be saying, you know, let's, you know, solve this thing. And it doesn't matter because it's just the alien. It's a frickin'
It's just waiting. That's what it's going to do. It's going to say anything it needs to do in order to make the most sense at that time.
Right. Yeah. It's pretty great. I like it. The only other piece of trivia that I have that I just wanted to make sure that I dropped in here was that apparently at one point there's a scene where Kurt Russell is blowing something up and he flies backwards. That is not your standard Hollywood rigging with a harness and a cable pulling him backwards. That was him actually not realizing how far a real stick of dynamite would concuss and blow. And he actually did get blown backwards next to a real stick of dynamite. Yeah.
I love that, like, not only were they not using CGI, they were using real dynamite to blow shit up.
They got some 21-year-old, you know.
Well, not only that, they put actual Kurt Russell next to a piece of dynamite.
Right, right. Not some stuntman.
Not only that, but all the guys who died in this movie died. They had to kill them all. That's how they used to make movies.
There's actually a thing. Oh, no.
Yeah, they had to kill the thing. It was amazing. No, I mean, they have a 21-year-old guy. This is how it used to work, right? This is how the entire world used to work, not just Hollywood. But you'd have some young person, and they didn't know what they were doing, but they were kind of talented. So someone said, hey, let's give him some dynamite. Put him next to this actor who we're paying a lot of money to. Oh, shit, he blew up, you know? It's like, oh, my God, none of this happens now. I mean, it's like the amount of money that that Tom Cruise's production company pays to insure him during his stunts for the Mission Impossible movies is like unheard of back in 1982 when this movie was made. They didn't even probably have insurance. That's my guess, at least. It's crazy. Crazy, crazy. What else do you guys have to talk about with this one, or are we going to wrap her up right here?
I think we pretty much covered it. I'd say we put a bow in it. I don't know. Byron, you got anything else?
I don't really have anything else. Once again, thank you guys for, I guess, forcing me to watch this film so I can talk about it. Another good one. I can't believe I missed this one.
It's a good one.
Well, and I, for one, am going to watch the prequel again. I'm going to give it another chance, man.
Give it a try. Give it a
yeah,
try.
I mean, I'll give it a chance. I'll give it a chance. You made your case.
Don't care so much about the CGI because that's just how things are done. You have to just really appreciate how it blends in.
I don't.
You know, it blends in.
I want things to be the way they used to be. I want them to actually kill the actors like they used to.
No. Yeah, use dynamite. Use real dynamite. Come on.
It's just so good. I mean, honestly, it's just so damn good. So anyway, Ward, what do you got coming up at the Parkway this month?
So the Great Northern Festival is doing a couple of events at the Parkway January 30th. A renowned photographer, Alex Soth, is going to be teaming up with drummer-composer Dave King. And on February 1st, there's an event called Outpost, which is a curated mix of live chamber music and It's going to be really cool. Great live streams put on by the Great Northern Festival. And we're not quite reopening yet. The theaters have been allowed to open at 25%, but the Parkway is not gonna open quite yet. But hopefully, not too far down the road, we're gonna have an actual live audience in the theater.
But
so,
you do have
Byron. What
well,
do you got?
Before you go there, you do have virtual cinema at the Parkway, which people can rent movies online. I am going to give my shout out to my vote for people watching the 2019 independent film Dead, which is very funny. I'm going to read real quick the synopsis here. Marbles, a hapless stoner, can see ghosts. Using a homemade concoction of neurological medication and marijuana, he's getting along just fine mediating between the living and the dead for a pittance of a living. Until Officer Jason Tagg, a recently dead wannabe super cop, makes him an auspicious offer. Help him find a serial killer in exchange for a hefty payout of life insurance. So those of you who have been a fan and listened to our podcast for the last year know that the movies that I like to watch on virtual cinema are these funny comedy ones. And coincidentally, many times they, for some reason, star people who can talk to the dead. I don't know why. The last one was with Will Forte, who was conjuring the dead. And anyway, it's absolutely great. You have to watch it. Check it out. And Byron, sorry to cut you off there. You go ahead. What are we doing next at the Funvee?
At the Funvee podcast, we are still on Timothy Dalton's James Bond, or variant of James Bond, and we are going to be reviewing License to Kill on our next episode, which will unfortunately be his last.
Yeah, second and last. Man, I don't know. Ward, what do you think? We haven't asked you this. Who's your favorite Bond?
You know, I grew up on Roger Moore. Uh-huh. He's kind of that's my guy. I think it's based on like when you were born.
I don't
claim that Roger Moore is the best Bond, but he's my favorite.
Yeah, I think without a doubt you hear that more than anything else. It's who you grew up with, who you saw on TV or in the movies, for sure. I think maybe people can't even objectively say, but obviously for me, objectively the best Bond is Daniel Craig. Anyways.
Go ahead.
Byron hates Daniel Craig. Come on, Byron.
I will save my comments for... You'll have to listen to them on the Funvee podcast we inevitably get to the Daniel Craig James Bond.
Oh, man. I can't wait. It's going to be great. Well, anyway, as always, if you'd like to reach out to the Parkway podcast, you can reach us at parkwaytheaterpodcast@gmail.com or give us a shout-out at 612-217-2520. Leave us a voicemail. We'll no doubt play it on the show. If you enjoyed this episode, coming up next, we'll be discussing... Gentlemen, what did we decide on? Why am I blanking now? What's the decision?
It's Valentine's Day. The next time we podcast will be Valentine's.
Is that
Valentine's,
give you a tip? So we're going to be talking the classic horror movie Valentine's Death Day. I don't know. Maybe it's
no.
That one.
No, it's quite no. A Titanic.
We're talking Titanic. Titanic,
that's right. Well, Titanic, maybe people have heard of it. Does that little Jimmy Cameron film, that youngster Jimmy who made a film once. And I don't know. We'll check it out. We'll see how I like it. For Ward and Byron, I'm Matt, signing off this episode of the Parkway Podcast.